Thank you very much, Rabbi Chessis, and on behalf of the Center for Modern Torah Leadership and the fellows of the Summer of Midrash, I want to thank the community so much for hosting the program as a whole and for learning with us. And personally, I love being able to give shirim to people who come out on relaxing summer evenings. I want nothing more to learn Torah, and I just want to warn you tonight that tonight's not going to be a relaxing shir. So you really need to put your thinking caps on tonight. Because as opposed to the other light shirim, this one's actually going to be really heavy. And there's a slight possibility that although I've been very, very disciplined and finished in 42 minutes every other shir, there's a slight possibility this one will go over, and I would suggest that probably even that we'll, when I finish lecturing, we're going to go in. I don't think I'm going to finish early this time. We're going to go into Marav, but I'll stay afterwards if people have questions or tomatoes, which is very likely to happen in the case of this shir, or it's possible my wife will stand up and just announce me as evil. I'm not sure if this is one of the shirim. It might be. Cucumbers. Okay, so the issue of brain death in halacha, really, in addition to the specific substantive issue, also raises a crucial issue of halachic process, which is, when you think about a new halachic issue, are you entitled to have either positively a rooting interest, this is where I want the halacha to go, or negative parameters, this is where the halacha can't go. So I want to talk about where the halacha can't go for a start. Because here is a very reasonable way for a technical halachist to engage in the issue of brain death. Brain death. New issue. Might be death. Might not be death. Well, we know how to deal with that halachically. We call it suffix death. Okay, so when there is a suffix, when there's a doubt, so then you hedge your bets as much as possible. And therefore, what we'll say is, if somebody asks you, should you donate your organs? Right, after brain death, we'll say, well, brain death might not be death. If you donate your organs, you are an accomplice to suicide. So certainly, you should not donate your organs because it's a suffix, right? Let alone be a transplant surgeon or anything like that. Okay, that's fine, so you don't donate. Now the question is, do you accept organs? Well, the answer is, you know what? The people who are donating, they might be right. It might not be death. So should I tell them, should I not accept organs just because of something, right? To stop them from doing something that they might be entitled to do. And so it is perfectly reasonable, as a matter of technical halakha, to say that the halakha is that Orthodox Jews can receive organs but not donate them.
This example doesn't follow, because you say the suffix is the suffix that he may not be dead.
Yeah.
That was the reason why he can't donate his organs. Then, if he definitely did die, and it wasn't just brain death, but
forget that.
Completely dead.
That's fine, but there's no hope then.
Then he won't be able to.
Yeah, but the organs won't last.
What?
The whole point of brain death is that organ donation is only possible because of brain death. If you're actually dead, you can't donate anymore. Right? The whole concept of organ donation for the vast majority of organs, as we are now, exists only because we call brain death death, or because we allow donations after brain death. We'll not bias here. So the first question I want to ask is that out of bounds? Right? Is it a legitimate halachic process to say up front, it is not possible for the halacha to end up in a position where Orthodox Jews receive organs but are unwilling to donate them? Some of you may know that this is actually an international crisis or Chilul Hashem, because Israel has the lowest organ donation rate in the Western world, and therefore has been kicked out of the transplant compacts with Europe because the difference is too large. So Rabbi Dov Linzer, the Rosh Yeshiva Shivat Chov Torah, who was here earlier this summer, wrote a public article in which he said this is intolerable and impossible. He said this in response to a report put out by the Rabbinical Council of America, which seemed to suggest correctly that certain Rosh Yeshiva in YU thought this was the correct psak. In response to Rabbi Linzer's attack, Rabbi Linzer's statement, Agudat Yisrael put out an unsigned statement in which they said that it was heretical to suggest that any decision reached by a great posek was immoral. And therefore one had to acknowledge the possibility of this being the correct psak, since some great poskim had in fact reached that result. So that is the first question. Right? Pardon? Okay, wait. Good. I published a piece, and this is page Bet of the Makarot. You can see parts of it. I published a piece in which I very largely took Rabbi Linzer's side on this one. And on this issue, I'm often very publicly state that, you know, that great poskim can make moral errors, that it can't be impossible to claim that great poskim made moral errors, and that there can be intellectually plausible halachic positions that are nonetheless evil. Yes?
So the infallibility principle doesn't
apply? No, there is no infallibility principle, right? There's no infallibility is one thing, that's intellectual error. There isn't even, right? You can make deep, profound moral errors. I think that the position that you can donate and not receive is a, as I think as Rabbi Linzer said, it's a morally intolerable position. But one has to be up front then, right? Because that it is, saying that it's morally intolerable is not the same as saying it's intellectually implausible. It's intellectually perfectly plausible. It's just morally intolerable.
Nor does it say that it's halachically permissible.
No, it doesn't. No, I say, but it's but right. But I want to be frank. Now there are people who will go further than that. There are people who will tell you that there is only one morally tolerable situation, answer to the situation, which is to allow organ donations. I want to be aware, that's a different position, right? All we've said so far is that I believe, with Rabbi Linzer, that it is intolerable to take the position that there is no reciprocity, that you receive without giving. That doesn't tell you whether you should both receive, or both not, right, or refuse to, right, whether you should both receive and give, or refuse to receive and give. So I want to bracket that question, and for now, but be aware that I'm not taking a position as to which of the two sides we should take. All right, so we looked at page Bet of the Makarot. That would right. You would see that. So now I want to turn now, if you can, to page Vav of the Makarot. Vav and Zion are facing in Hebrew and English, and let's talk about the history of Jewish definitions of death. So Talmud Yoma 83a tells us there's a Mishnah, and the Mishnah deals with the case of somebody who is inside a ruin on Shabbat and on right or underneath the underneath an, a leaning wall, and the wall collapses, and they're now buried in the rubble, or they're in an earthquake, whatever it is, they're buried in the rubble, and the process of digging out the rubble will cause violations of Shabbat. We could have all sorts of conversations about exactly how, but they will. So the question is, can you violate Shabbat to try and dig somebody out from underneath a pile of rubble? So the answer. The answer generally is that if there's a safek for koch nefesh, we're not going to deal today with the issue of Jewish and non-Jewish life, because that is an issue which exists in theory, but in general, practically, we evade. So we deal with just on the assumption all lives are the same for these purposes. And the answer is, if there's any risk, if there's any chance of life, you violate Shabbat. And that's our normal case. So the question is, so it would take an absolute proof that there is nobody alive in the rubble to cause us to stop digging. How would you get that absolute proof? So the way you can get it, the Talmud says, is if you know there was only one person in there and you dig up their body. But often their body will be partially in the rubble. So what parts of the body do you have to have access to in order to determine death? So the Talmud Yoma says that there are two possible positions. One position is you have to have access to his nose, and the other is you have to have access to his heart. Okay, second debate over whether he's upside down or right side up. Not our issue right now, in order for these to be true. Obviously, if he's upside down, then you can't get to the heart without reaching the nose, right? So it makes a
Sorry, if he's right side up, you can't get to the heart without reaching the nose. So it depends whether these criteria are additive or separate. Which way you are? Okay. So now, a reasonable way of understanding this argument is to say that the position which says that we hold up to your nose believes that the death is defined as the absence of respiration, not breathing. That's what we check with your nose, and that person who says we check onto your heart says that the definition of death is cessation of heartbeat. All right, these are usually right, respiratory death or cardiac death. Okay, there are, however, right, this is how, you know, if you got to somewhere around the 18th century, this is pretty much what the conversation would have sounded like, except that it never came up. Because this is a very rare situation, and right, you know, it only occurs on Shabbos, so when it comes time to bury somebody, you get their whole body. So it's really an almost entirely theoretical conversation. There is another problem. The other problem is that this conversation takes place among people who have no idea that there is a thing called oxygen or how it functions. So they're right, or really right, have no idea of the circulatory system. Right, because this is long before William Harvey discovers the circulatory system, let alone people discover that respiration oxygenates the blood. So it's very hard to know on a conceptual level what this definition is supposed to mean, how we translate it. Right, so that's one issue, that if you're what the late Dr. Benjamin Friedman, in a wonderful book called Duty and Healing, says there's an approach to halakha called physicalism. Physicalism is you take the exact psak in the past and you apply it in the same way, regardless of whether the underlying principle still makes sense to you. So, for example, Rav Moshe Feinstein has a tshuva in which he addresses the question of whether it's permitted to donate blood. Donating blood is a violation of self-wounding, so it should be forbidden. Except that the Talmud holds that occasional bloodletting is healthy, because the Talmud follows the medical positions that believe that occasional bloodletting is healthy. So Rav Feinstein suggests that it should be permissible to donate blood, not because it is healthy for others, but because the Talmud paskins it's healthy to you. But it has an issue, because the Talmud says that you shouldn't do this on particular days of the week because of astrological features that make bloodletting on those days unhealthy. So you would end up having to paskin that you can donate blood, but not on Tuesday afternoons. Now, that's true, halachically, if you approach it that way, but it's also very difficult to think that we really ought to paskin that way if we don't actually believe that bloodletting is healthy or that the healthiness of bloodletting is affected by astrological phenomena. So that's so the same issue is true when you deal with definitions of death. To what extent should we continue definitions of death that are based on physiological understandings that are not the same as ours? Now, in this case, mostly though, it's not it wasn't a big deal, because even after you develop an understanding of oxygenation and circulation, it's still true that cessation of respiration and cessation of heartbeat are reasonably good proxies for something that we might call death. And it turns out that death is a very, very problematic category. It turns out that whatever you call death does not mean the death of every cell in your body. There are always cells that go on for a long time. So death does not mean the death of every particular part of the body. And so it might be that there is no single definition of death, and heartbeat and respiration are reasonable proxies for whatever it is that you want, that your culture or your legal system wants to call death. I want to be clear, right, that nobody has adduced any biblical evidence at all. So we have no idea what God calls death. All right, so that this is something that is left entirely to human hands. And the second issue, which is, I go like this. Probably all of you get that I haven't been dead for the last 5 seconds. But I'm not breathing. So it has to be more than just not, right? It can't be not breathing, therefore dead. So we have to come up with things like permanently not breathing. So the problem is that that we have machines that can just compress your stomach in and out. So if you think breathing is just the right, it's just the intake and outtake of certain gases, so that can be mechanically simulated. So what does it mean? Right, there are people who cannot breathe on their own, but the rest of their body functions. We attach them to what we call respirators. Right, respirators are things that help you breathe if you cannot breathe on your own. Are you dead? We have operations, right, a part of which involves stopping the heart. We even have an operation called cardiac transplant, part of which involves removing the heart. When we remove the heart, is the person dead? Rav Moshe Feinstein famously suggested in an early responsum that heart transplants were double murder. But part of that was when you removed the heart of the patient, you were killing them. And this raised all sorts of interesting questions. For example, did they have to remarry their wives if they survived? Right, which is part of a much broader question of whether you have to remarry your wife after resurrection. Raises all sorts of complicated issues. But what I want to convey here is that there is not an easy conceptual way of moving from classical definitions of death in terms of respiration and heartbeat to contemporary definitions. But it's also not obvious that what we should be doing is just maintaining the classical definitions. Because the classical definitions are based on premises that are not necessarily shared by us. Okay, so when the issue of brain death came up, another Mishnah was introduced. This is source number 2 on page on Vav and Zayin. Mishnah Ohalot says, human beings are not mitame, right, until their nefesh departs. Being mitame means they're not dead for the purposes of tum'ah. Right? The dead body creates tum'ah. Human beings do not create tum'ah until their nefesh departs. Okay, that gives us a very simple definition of death, when the nefesh is gone. All we need now is evidence. We have a definition, that's great. We don't have any, right? What constitutes evidence the nefesh has departed? Even if their arteries are severed, or if they're irreversibly and imminently dying, they are legally alive for all legal matters, including those that accept the status of others, such as marriage. So too, domestic animals and non-domestic animals, behemot and chayot, are not mitameh until their nefesh departs. We discover that whatever nefesh is, it is not something that is unique to humanity, which is important. However, if they are decapitated, if their heads have been chopped off, even though they are mifarches, even though there is something, right, even though their limbs are still moving, they are mitameh. Then they are, right, then in fact, they are, it seems, dead. Let's assume that this last line applies to human beings and not just animals. This enables us to assume that decapitated human beings are dead. Now you might think, isn't it obvious that decapitated human beings are dead? No, it's not so obvious that decapitated human beings are dead. Because decapitated bodies can do all sorts of interesting things nowadays. So long as you continue oxygenating the blood. For example, decapitated human beings can give birth to healthy children. And that is a fairly horrifying thing, but it's true. And this was involved in a famous experiment about brain death, in which actually involved, or was supposed to involve, didn't really involve, was supposed to involve chopping off the head of a sheep, and then of a pregnant sheep, and then keeping the body long enough for it to deliver, which has been done. So it's a challenging thing to say, right? It's not so obvious anymore why it's dead. We could ask, which part is dead? Because right, you have stories from the French Revolution of guillotined heads speaking after they are removed. So which part of it is dead? These are all a bit, this is not an appetizing share. We'll try and make it a little bit macabre humor. We'll get to zombies too. But nonetheless, we have a Mishnah which Nothing really has changed in terms of that yet, which seems to say that decapitated human beings are dead no matter what happens afterwards. Even if the head speaks, the head is dead, the body gives birth, the body is dead. A decapitated human being, the person is dead. Yes, Ben?
I mean, the Gemara acknowledges the case of a cow giving, being slaughtered and then giving, and then subsequently having the fetus taken out. And
yeah, but that's not giving birth. That's having the fetus taken out by C-section. We're talking about giving birth. Right, and you know, really sustaining it through, right? It's the question how long it can be, right? That's the whole debate. Okay, so now there are two questions over here. One is, why is a decapitated human being dead? Or animal? And two is brain death the equivalent of decapitation? Now those two questions are connected. Right? You have to, so Rabbi Moshe David Tendler, in the 1970s, claimed that brain death was the equivalent of decapitation. That the whole purpose, the reason decapitation was death, is that the brain was no longer connected to the rest of the body. And therefore, having a completely non-functional brain, even if the rest of your body functions, why should it matter to us whether the head is physically connected or not? So long as it is dead. Now, this is not obvious for a whole set of reasons. The first of it is that in order to decapitate somebody, you also have to sever their trachea and esophagus, which is the usual definition of shechita. So it might be that chopping off the head has nothing to do with the head; has to do with severing what we call the simanim. Let's bracket that question. So Tendler claimed that the reason for this was that the Harvard criteria of brain death, as established, marked the complete lysis of the brain, meaning that the brain was completely liquefied, and there were no brain cells alive in the brain, so it might as well not be there. He did this because there were experiments which involved injecting a traceable dye into the blood, and then seeing whether that dye appeared on scans of the brain. If it didn't, that presumed that there was no oxygen in the brain, and therefore everything must be, that because the blood wasn't going to the brain, therefore the brain must be completely dead. My teacher, and that will tell you my bias, Rabbi J. David Bleich, said that this was simply false, that there was residual electrical activity in the brain, that the tests were not sufficiently sensitive to catch what was going on, and so far as I know, it is now universally conceded that he was right, and that brain death, that bodies meeting the Harvard criteria of brain death, have not actually suffered complete liquefaction. There are cells in the brain alive. There is residual electrical activity. And more particularly, there is a particular element of the brain called the hypothalamus, which may actually be intact and functioning. But here's the interesting thing. The hypothalamus, now I am not in any way an expert in these things, so I'm just sort of parroting words. So if I say something ridiculous, you should tell me. But as I understand it, the interesting thing about the hypothalamus is that while it is part of the brain, it is not part of the nervous system. It is part of the endocrine system. And so now we have an interesting question. What happens? Let's say that it is true that I don't in any way wish to get involved in the controversy about this. Let's say that it is true that if a patient meets the Harvard criteria for brain death, and we'll leave aside exactly how you verify the criteria and the whole debate to the Israeli chief rabbi and other people about what exactly constitutes adequate verification of meeting those criteria. Let's say that the patient actually meets the Harvard criteria. Let's say that that means that there is no neurological control of any other part of any part of the body from the head. Is that death? You can't say it's decapitation anymore because you have the hypothalamus surviving. You can't say that there's no brain because there's residual electrical activity. But can you say that that what we mean by death and the reason that decapitation was death is connected to a different definition of death, which is also satisfied by the claim that there is no centrally directed activity. There is no activity directed by the central nervous system from the brain in the body. Okay, so now that much more precise definition than Rabbi Tendler was, I believe. I had never known this, but sometime, I guess it must be middle of last year, I was reading. It might have been I was reading this old tradition that somebody had left as reading material in shul, and I saw an article about Rav Nachum Rabinovich, who was the great posik, who was the Rosh Yeshiva Ol Yadumim, on organ transplant and brain death in 1968, and I said, wow, that's really early. I didn't know that it came up, and he made an argument that I said, oh my goodness, this is where it came from. It wasn't Rabbi Tendler's claim necessarily at all. There was a prior claim about it, and I said, but it's wrong. So this is where we're going now. So if you take a look at source number three, this is the commentary of the Rambam to the Mishnah and Oholot that we just read, and we're on pages above in Zion. And I had given you the Hebrew is, I believe, the translation by Rav Yosef Kapach. There are two translations of the Rambam Perush Mishnayot, one by Rav Ibn Tibbon, the other with the medieval translation, the other by Rav Kapach, which is modern. My tradition from Dr. Chaim Soloveitchik is that actually these translations often, sometimes they're just differences of translation, sometimes they're actually translating different editions of the book, and that explains the differences between them. However, for our purposes, I believe that in this case, none of the translation differences matter. Right, the Hebrew is roughly the same. But the Rambam's commentary is written in Arabic. So I'm giving you the English translation of one particular Hebrew translation of the Arabic, but I think that it doesn't make much difference here. It says, the movements which the limbs move after death is called pirkus. The lata, whatever that is, right? Which is this animal? Sorry, my translation fails there, because this animal, its tail moves for some time after it is severed. Okay, so there exists an animal, some kind of lizard, that you chop it off, and the tail still twitches. Right, frog's legs move. Right. This happens to some species of animal. V'yerazela miksat minei balechayim. If the motive force was not spread to all the limbs from one foundation and source, but rather is divided throughout the body. Okay. Rav Rabinovich, as best I can tell, and we don't have time to do it now, but if you saw it in Chavrusta, the pages Gimel and Dalet of the Gimel, Dalet, and Hay of the source sheet is a written dialogue between myself and Rav Rabinovich on this topic. Because as soon as I saw this, I went to the Malei Damim website, and they have a Sha'alat HaRav feature, so I was Sha'alat HaRav, and I said, the Rav wrote this in 1968, and it doesn't make any sense to me. And much to my surprise and joy, he responded, personally. But it wasn't any clearer to me. So I wrote back again in English this time, because I thought maybe my Hebrew was unclear. And he responded in English. At the end of it, so far as I can tell, nothing has changed. So I will just present to you what he said and what I think, and you can decide for yourself, recognizing that he has much greater stature than I do, but Hemet Yored Darko, I can't say anything other than what I think to be the truth. He says that this sentence proves that the definition of death, in some way, is having the motive force spread throughout the body rather than centralized. I don't see it at all. I think that what the Rambam says is that the fact that lizards' tails twitch after they are severed demonstrates that twitching is not by itself a sign of life. He doesn't mean that the tail of the lizard is dead. He just means the fact that, right, and that proves that whatever, right, that just like the lizard's tail is dead, so too the rest of us is dead. No, all he means is that this proves that there is a thing we call a galvanic motion, whatever you want to call it, that there is, right, that there is a possibility of movement that does not indicate centralized control. And centralized control may be a sufficient evidence for life, but it doesn't mean the absence of it is indication of death. So if my argument is correct, then it turns out that there is exactly no evidence that brain death is halachic death. It's not cessation of respiration, it's not cessation of heartbeat, and it's not decapitation. All right, so now you'll tell me that it's all very well and good, but you said at the beginning, Rabbi Klaffer, that there are conclusions you can't reach halachically. You can't reach the conclusion that it's okay to receive and not donate. Is it okay to reach the conclusion that it's not okay to either receive or donate? Doesn't that mean that you're sacrificing the lives of all sorts of people who have years and years and years of health in front of them in exchange for the lives of people who are not even conscious and will never be conscious again? So is it morally tolerable to reach the halachic conclusion, or is it obvious that the proper Jewish response in terms of pikuach nefesh has to be that we are going to save the people whose lives are in danger? Much of the halachic brain death rhetoric you read will be framed in terms of that. There is a Jewish value of pikuach nefesh. How can we let these people die when we can save them? I want to suggest that this is completely backwards. On the basis of what I think is perhaps the most important passage in the Talmud for all sorts of issues relating to halacha and ethics. So if you look now at source number 4, so the Talmud is engaged in a conversation about which mitzvot one has to die rather than violate. So it says the big three, as you all know, are avodah zarah, Gilui Arayot, right? So there's sins associated with false gods and sins associated with the false worship of God and sins associated with sexual sins and bloodshedding. So the Gemara says, how do you know Avodah Zarah? And it says, V'ahavta Hashem Elokecha b'chol levavcha u'b'chol nafshecha. You have to love God with all your nefesh, even if he takes your nefesh. How do I know that you have to die rather than commit certain kinds of sexual sins? So the answer is that there is a comparison in one case first in the Torah between rape and murder. And therefore we say that just like you have to die rather than commit murder, you also have to die rather than engage in certain kinds of sexual sins. Okay, which Talmud says, yeah, but how do we know that you have to die rather than commit murder? And here you would think the answer should be there's a verse in the Torah which says you can't, but there isn't. What the Talmud says is svarahu. This is a principle derived entirely from reason. What does it mean? As in the case of that one who came before Rava and said to him, the Lord of my manor said to me, go kill so-and-so, and if not, I will kill you. Rava said to him, let him kill you, but you must not kill. What have you seen that makes you believe that your blood is redder? Perhaps the blood of that man is redder. So the fundamental principle of Jewish ethics, the one which we say that really, we're not even going to try to write a biblical source for, and I want to argue that means that if you don't get this intrinsically, there's no hope you're going to get anything else in Torah right. Right? This is our test, right? If you understand this intuitively, then you get to learn the rest of Torah. If not, then you're not going to get anything right. The fundamental principle is, what have you seen that your blood is redder than his? We don't make distinctions among lives. And therefore, the argument that so-and-so's life is not worth as much as so-and-so's life, that there is an ethical imperative to save person X at the expense of person Y because person Y is dying anyway is, to my mind, against the most fundamental principle of Jewish ethics. If they are alive, then you can't choose among lives. All the moral imperative goes the other way. Okay, so far of the shir, which goes that direction, now we're going to completely reverse ground, just to warn you, because it may be a little dizzying. The problem is that this ethical principle, which is the undeniable principle, not only is it not supported by a biblical verse, it's actually directly opposed to a biblical verse. Which is, if you move to source number 5, so in source number 5, Gemara of Metzia quotes, very famous Breita, two people walking along the road and there's a canteen in the hands of one of them and there's only enough water for one of them. So what are they supposed to do? There's only enough water. If one of them drinks, then he makes it to civilization, the other one dies. They both drink, they both die. So Ben Petora, whoever he was, comes along and says, let them both drink and one of them should not see the other one die. Until Rabbi Akiva comes along and says, V'che achicha imach, your brother shall live with you until you're alive.
Love.
Right. Love. My fault? Typo? Live. Sorry, not love. Live. Not love. Live. My fault. Tara. Should have corrected all those typos. I don't know how they happen. Your brother shall live with you. Well, your brother shall live with you. You've got to be alive first. Therefore, your life comes before your brother's life. Here we have a fairly astonishing thing. So we have a biblical verse, which means that your life comes before your brother's verse. And yet we have a principle derived from reason, which says that you cannot choose your life over your brother's. So how can those be true? I want to note how astonishing it was that Rava said that I know that you can't kill another person to save your life from reason, when he was fully aware that it was a biblical verse which said your life comes first. She had her hand up. Yes.
You can't sacrifice your life to save his life, and you can't kill him to save your life.
Okay. You can't sacrifice your life to save his life. Interesting. But you can
give him your water. If you're the owner of the water, you get to live.
You can drink the water, even though you can drink the water. Okay. Is that reason? Is that an obvious distinction that you can choose your life over somebody else's with regard to drinking the water, but you can't with regard to killing them? Why is that obvious?
Active as opposed to passive.
Aha, so you think the active-passive distinction, but it's not really passive. You're not letting him die, right? You're actively drinking the water. Right? Active-passive is nice, but it's not quite. That is an interesting question. Can you steal the water or not? That is a matter of grave controversy, whether you're entitled to steal the water or not. Not 100% clear.
Of course, that's killing him.
I don't know. Not killing him, you're just stealing the water.
Pekuach nefesh, you're allowed to steal the water.
Absolutely. Theft is permitted for pekuach nefesh. Okay, good. Great question. These are challenges. Daniel, you had a question? Yeah.
You argue not giving the water to him is akin to killing him. Giving the water to him is akin to killing yourself.
And not killing him is akin to killing yourself if the guy's going to shoot you. So we can say this involved in the third moral actor, as we can complicate it in all sorts of interesting ways. In other words, it's not, I don't think it's obvious anymore. That's my point. I don't think it's obvious. Yes, Deborah. There are two ways of reading the question. There are two ways of reading the question. One way it is rhetorical, and one way it is descriptive. The usual way in which one wishes to demonstrate that you prefer to read it rhetorically than descriptively is to point out that there is a Mishnah at the end of Horiot, which seems to suggest that men's lives are more valuable than women's. If we allow the consideration of why one person's life is better than others, then we allow all those sorts of considerations. I would much rather not allow those considerations into halacha, and therefore I am much more comfortable reading it as rhetorical, which I think is also correct, happily, because nothing in the story of the Gemara, right, you know, the next line should be, well, I know perfectly well why my blood is redder than his. I'm younger, and I have better, right, and I have more interesting children, and right, and he can't write poetry for beans. And gosh darn it, he's a Red Sox fan. I mean, right? Or I'm a Red Sox fan, so my blood is redder than his, right? Right. That if it were intended descriptively as a really a question, Rabbi said, I don't know. Maybe you can kill him. What have you seen that your blood is redder than his? Right? I'm sure you would have had lots of answers. Lots and lots and lots of answers. Everyone knows why their blood is redder than somebody else's. I think it has to be a rhetorical question. But I cannot deny that there are, you know, that the test case that people come up with is, for example, what if it's 2-on-1? Now I know my blood is not redder, but there's more of it. Right, and there are other cases where it comes up, but I would much rather not read it that way. Okay, time running short. Let's suppose all this is true. I suppose everything I have said absolutely is true. Does that mean that that organ transplants from brain dead patients are forbidden? So I think the answer is no. So here's why. There is a terrifying, terrifying experiment conducted by Robert Truog, who is the head of pediatric medicine and ethics, I think, at Harvard Medical School.
He's an intensivist at Children's and a director of ethics at Boston.
Yes. It's a terrifying, terrifying experiment in which he takes several neonates who are hypoencephalic, I believe. They have basically born with no higher brain function. And he wants to engage in pediatric heart transplants because these kids are not going to survive and never going to have conscious life anyway. So what he did was he injects their bodies with a fluid that causes their hearts to stop. Now it happens that the current definition of death in Massachusetts is you are dead if your heart has stopped long enough for you to be unable to restart it spontaneously. You're dead. Even though there is a gap between the time in which your heart can restart spontaneously and the time in which we can restart the heart by stimulating it. So what he did was he stopped the hearts, declared the kids dead, then restarted the hearts. And now he had perfectly healthy pediatric hearts that he could transplant. So he then removed the hearts and put them in other kids who he thought were more worthy of life, and then dared people to prosecute him for murder on the grounds that the kids were legally dead the first time. Now you could prosecute him for stopping their hearts, but it's hard to prosecute somebody for murder when they were alive again 5 minutes later. He restarted their hearts, and then you could try and prosecute him for taking their hearts out, but they were legally dead. He declared them so. And that was his attempt to challenge the notion that the reason that brain death is the transplantations from brain dead organ from brain dead people is legitimate is because the brain dead people are dead. He said they're not dead. We just think that their lives are worthless. And so he created this experiment to demonstrate that that's not really why people thought it. Okay, as I've just said, that kind of experiment is, to my mind, in principle, deeply, deeply, deeply offensive to every notion possible of Jewish ethics. And yet, it's not necessarily wrong. So let's take a look at page Chet and Tet. So there is a Shi'iltot Rav Chai Gaon on Parshat Emor. This is a Gaonic work, which says the following. Actually, we'll start with the Shulchan Aruch on page 6. Right? Shulchan Aruch says that if your neck is broken, most of the flesh together with it, source number 6, right? And similarly, one who is torn from the back like a fish, if you're still alive, right, you're dead, you cause tuma. But if you're a ghostase or you have your esophagus and tracheus loaded with many wounds, you're not dead, right? You're only dead when your tuma, when your nefesh departs. But on this, the Shi'iltot says, when there is a person who fell and his neck broken too, with most of the flesh severed along with it, even though his neshama has not departed, he is dead. That's an interesting line. What does that mean? Even though his neshama has not departed, he is dead. So this is what I established in the first shir here. So this is what we call halachic zombies. People who are dead, even though they still have neshamot in their body. But at that time, people said to me, Rabbi Clapper, you can't build a whole halachic theory on one obscure geonic source, which certainly I would not do. So, in the 20th century, Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg said the following. Eliezer Waldenberg is one of the great, I think many of us would say, you know, one of the two or three great Jewish medical halachists of the late 20th century. The doctor faces the issue of ceasing care. I emphasize that the question is only when the medical evaluation is that the patient's condition is severe with no hope of being saved, so in order to prevent the ongoing hard suffering of the patient, and to enable him to die a beautiful death, a death of honor, and not to demean him by transforming him for no purpose into a being with many tubes that destroy the divine image within him. So it emerges that according to what we have said, that even according to Rama, in our case, it is permitted to even actively remove the ventilator. Since thereby we are ceasing only the life motion that is coming to him from outside, and we are doing no action at all that has the capacity to cease intrinsic life, since it becomes clear that this has already ceased. So as this Eliezer says, you can imagine there is a case in which the patient is engaged in ongoing mechanical respiration. And you take them off the respirator, because while they are alive, they are not intrinsically alive. Now, what does that mean? They're alive or not intrinsically alive. It can't mean that they can't breathe on their own. This is right where I always come up with scuba divers. Right, scuba divers are alive. If you cut their tubes, you are not merely removing a source of extrinsic life. So you have to explain what the difference is between a patient on a ventilator and a scuba diver. So Rabbi Waldenberg says one thing with which I disagree with violently. That people lose their tzelem elokim because of physical things that happen to them with tubes. Yes, I find this deeply, deeply troubling. Deeply, 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 deeply troubling. People do not lose their tzelem elokim. Stephen Hawking has a tzelem elokim. Also, as Rabbi Dr. David Shaptai happily pointed out to me, the actual case that Cecil Ezra addresses does not exist. If you try and come up with the mechanical reality, with the physical analog of the case he discusses, it turns out to be impossible. So there is some question as to how much halachic weight one should give to a tshuva that, A, I find morally deeply problematic, and B, deals with a case that is physically impossible. If you look at the whole case, you'll see like he's dealing with like a patient who there's a combination of heartbeat and brain function that just can't happen. If you look at the cat, I don't remember the cat, but look at it, it's not a real case. Somebody misinformed him as to what the reality was, and he couldn't get it right. It's not a brain death case. Okay, Rabbi Chaim, I'm sorry, I should have got kind of clear in my head. I'm not my fault. Reb Chaim David Halevi was another Sephardi chief rabbi of Tel Aviv. An article in Tchumen, dealing also with the detached respirator, says the following. Rather, it further seems to my impoverished intellect that even if the doctors wish to continue and keep them alive via the respirator, they are not permitted to do so. All right, there are people whom you can keep alive via respirators, but you're forbidden to attach them to respirators. As indeed is already being explained, as we saw in the shir number one, that you can't extend the life of a goses by artificial means. For example, by placing salt in his tongue and chopping wood. When halacha discusses a goses is alive owing to his own powers, and who therefore has great agony, whereas in our case he feels no pain or suffering, and I think that's very important, because people often think that you have to end the life for the sake of the patient. But the truth is, if the patient has no consciousness, they have no pain. And the reaction, you say, like, you know, that you want to spare them suffering. If you really feel they have no consciousness, they have no suffering. And that they react physiologically to being poked with a pin tells you nothing whatsoever about actual discomfort. And this is a contradiction in the way people often treat the issue, which really needs to be addressed much more. It's the same way. There's a marvelous book by anthropologist Margaret Locke called Twice Dead, where she talks about how nurses cover brain-dead patients with blankets because they think they're shivering. They're shivering. But the whole point is, right, if you really, they think, these are patients who they believe are dead. So, right, it's much more, right, many of these things are more about the comfort of the comfort of the caregiver than the comfort of the carees, which is, I think, important to know. It's called, it's, okay. However, but it seems to my impoverished intellect that not only is it permitted to detach him from the respirator, but even that there's an obligation to do so, even though there's no pain. For indeed, the nefesh of a human being, which is the property of the Holy One who is blessed, has already been taken by the Holy One who is blessed from this human being. As behold, he will die immediately once the machine had been removed, quite the reverse. Via this artificial respiration, we are leaving the nefesh within him and causing the nefesh suffering by trapping it within a body. Because the nefesh wants to go back to heaven. And God has really severed the connection between this nefesh and the body, but you are imprisoning it in the body. Yes?
How can we know how long we need to wait before a person possibly can somehow become alert again? Sometimes people who seem brain dead, but they're on respirators, people are in their hospital rooms and talking to them, and then later they become...
So we need to distinguish very, very sharply between people who are comatose, people who are in a permanent vegetative condition, and people who are brain dead. Okay, if the claims about brain death are correct, then there is absolutely no hope that a patient who has been diagnosed as brain dead will recover. All right, that's very. There are many patients who have been misdiagnosed with as being a permanent condition, and many patients are in comas, but the claim is that patients who have been correctly diagnosed with brain death have never recovered. Right, there are always the Terry Schiavo, you know, cases where there's a fight about whether, in fact, they were correctly diagnosed. Let's assume that you can put in criteria where the risk of misdiagnosis is so low that you can halakhically account for it, and actually halakha is fairly tolerant of misdiagnosis because it happens, interestingly enough, that the controversy about time of death arose in the context of a German government decree which wished to delay burial for 3 days, lest patients were actually alive and misdiagnosed. And if you look in, many Victorian graves actually are built with alarm systems and things like that, so the patient can ring the bell if they're dead. And unfortunately, because if you dig up Victorian graves, you often find that they have scratch marks on the inside, because people often got it wrong. Nonetheless, the Chasam Sofer Paskin, then we go that way, that you bury people immediately. So we're actually very tolerant of error in determination of death, so that's not so much the issue. I'm late, so you have to ask me afterwards. Okay. So what we have is now Gaonim and two modern Poskim, each of whom suggests that there is a condition in which the patient is better off dead. To the point where Chaim David Halevi says that the question is not whether you are allowed to disconnect the respirator. The question is whether you are allowed to connect the respirator. Because as we saw in the first year, there is a category called the Goses Zman Aruch, the person who is dying for a long time such that you believe that their soul is trapped in their body as opposed to inhabiting their body. Now, here's what I want to suggest. Throughout all of history, there was no way of knowing whether a patient was goses or goses zman aruch, or in my terms, whether they were dying or a zombie. The only way you could tell was that zombies died more easily than dying people, so that there were things you could do, and you would say, well, you know what? If the person's a zombie, they'll die, so it's fine. And if they're dying, they won't die, so it's fine also. You can take away the woodchopper because dying people don't die because you removed a loud noise. Zombies die because you removed a loud noise. Right? You can fail to put salt on their tongue. All those criteria were criteria for distinguishing between the people who really you had an interest in keeping alive and the people whom you had no interest in keeping alive. So I want to suggest that, but the world has changed. We now have a category of people whom we can tell are in that condition. And that's people who are brain dead. Right? As opposed to defining brain death as death, for which I think there is no traditional basis, although it wouldn't be ridiculous, it's just no traditional basis for doing it. And I think it's hard to say. There's no single criterion. The claim that it's not a unified organism, it's not true that the endocrine system functions. The circulatory system functions. You're not a you may not be a neurologically unified body, but that's a radical definition of death. If you want to adopt it, that's great, but and I think that we could do it by takana if we decided to do that, but I don't think we can claim it's a continuation of the past. But we can say is that people who are brain dead have no interest in being alive, and we could define them as people whose souls are trapped in their bodies, as opposed to people whose souls inhabit their bodies. If that is the case. So now, the question becomes not are you allowed to take one life to save another, because really, in principle, you're allowed, right? Rechandelay says you can take the life directly if you can do it without causing pain. Right? If it weren't for ancillary issues, you could shoot them, because you're liberating them. Right? If you really know that's who they are. So in such circumstances, the question becomes reversed. Is it permitted to maintain people alive? But in this, right, what we're doing, as opposed to all of Shulchan Aruch says, you have an obligation to end the suffering of the Goseis Manaruch and allow the soul to depart. Really, the question in brain death is, are you allowed to extend the suffering and perpetuate the soul in the body so that you can eventually take the organs out and allow another person to live? So that is not a question of choosing one life over another. That is a question of choosing the suffering of one person, of one soul. Right, choosing to cause one soul suffering with the reward of saving another person's life. So I want to argue that if there is a solid ground halachically for donating and accepting organ donations, it's not because brain death is death, it's because brain death is a condition that makes death more desirable than life. And that can be acknowledged. And that can be acknowledged halachically in this fashion. There are still, I think, issues that need to be addressed. There is what we call the ir miklat issue, which is that transplant patients are told not to go out of town on holiday weekends. Because brain death does not happen because people live a long time. People live a long time and have the rest of their body break down. Brain death happens because young men get on motorcycles and crash. And so you have the ir miklat problem is that accidental homicides have to go to an ir miklat and stay there until the Kohen Gadol dies, so therefore they're going to end up praying for the Kohen Gadol to die. So this is a risk when you have, it's a moral risk when you have people praying for someone else to crash into a motorcycle, right, to crash their motorcycle. That, I think, is a deep moral issue that we need to address as a society. There's also the possibility that a transplant surgeon at BU told me in a lecture some years ago that actually it's less of a pressing moral issue the other way than we thought, because their brain death may become obsolete in the not-too-distant future, because brain death is a function of a very particular physiological phenomenon, which is pressure on the brain from uncontrolled, right? When you have fluids on the brain that compress the brain to the point where there's no oxygen to the brain, but the rest of the body is sustainable. And he suggested that methods of easing cerebral pressure would soon improve to the point that nobody would ever be brain dead the other way, because that would not be a reasonable consequence of action. So it may be that the issue will become moot if he's right, but he said that to me 6 years ago, and I don't see any signs of it being the case. So what I want to suggest is that I don't think, you should all be aware, right, that I'm taking a position that there's a huge controversy. There are the people who say brain death really is death for the reasons I gave you, either because lack of central neurological control is death, or because they really believe that it's complete decapitation, and they read the Rambam that way. There are people who say that brain death is not death at all, and therefore donation and reception are both murder. And I am taking, so far as I know, an utterly idiosyncratic position. Which is that brain death is not death, and yet organs can be both taken and received. So you should be aware that, in terms of authority, that this position rests on these very narrow shoulders. At the same time, I hope that this is useful in at least, you know, in at least getting people to challenge what the normal pieties of the situation are. Now I think we'll leave everyone with this calm and relaxing introduction to Marav, where you say you're supposed to learn Dvar Halacha before Marav so that nobody has anything on their mind when we go when we go to davening. So now we've all been doing that.